This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. Criminal justice reform is a key issue of concern in our region, and that was true even before the COVID-19 pandemic and the re-energized movement for racial justice. Let's talk about how these two global events may be shaping our perspective of criminal justice here at home right now. Joining us via Skype is Claudine Fox. She's a campaign manager with the ACLU of Connecticut. Ms. Fox, hello, and thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Has the push for criminal justice reform changed at all since the beginning of the pandemic? What are you seeing in those terms?
I think, if anything, the push for criminal justice reform has kind of adopted the era in which we're in with the COVID-19 pandemic. A lot of what the World Health Organization was saying regarding the spread of COVID and being in, communal facilities and all of that. If we think about what our prisons and jails actually look like right now, folks who are incarcerated are living within a communal facility. And so folks that are fighting for criminal justice reform have definitely just adopted and shifted our talking points and our focus to really think about how do we continue to make change and protect people from dying from this disease.
Would you say this is a moment in time, a special moment, or is it just another minor turning point in terms of the push for criminal justice reform?
I think it's both. I think it is. I think it's definitely a moment, right? I think the pandemic has really pushed people to think about how our systems at large function. Who was more greatly impacted by the pandemic? Folks that lost jobs, parents working at home and having to take care of their little ones and homeschooling and all of that. I think the pandemic really shined a light on how some of our larger systems function and how they are actually kind of dysfunctional. And the same was with criminal justice reform and the push for police accountability. It really opened up a lot of people's eyes to see how things are actually moving and how it can impact communities and individuals and systems as a whole.
Does then that this situation, this moment, move things along more quickly or in a more focused way? Or are we just moving along at the same pace? I guess I'm wondering, will this really lead to something concrete in terms of change?
Yes, I do think something has shifted inherently because of how I said more people are kind of waking up to recognize how our systems actually function. I do think you might see some of the movements around criminal justice reform, police accountability reform. I do think we'll start to see things moving a little bit faster because there are larger public outcries for accountability from our legislators and from our systems alike. I do think there's a shift there.
And then, of course, there's the resurgence or the re-energizing of the Black Lives Matter movement, the outrage over the murder of George Floyd. How does that figure into this moment in time combined with the pandemic?
I think I like thinking about it as the resurgence of the movement, because this is something communities, Black and Latinx communities, have been fighting for generations, right? And I think, with the pandemic, again, we're sitting at home, we might be paying more attention to the news, we might be paying more attention to posts on Facebook or social media. And so folks are seeing things that the organizers and the activists have been like crying from the rooftops for generations, and more people are getting involved. And again, when we start to think about how all of our systems, our education system, our policing system, our criminal legal system, how all of these different things start to intersect, you start to see more people having conversations that maybe weren't speaking to each other before. And so when we think about the movement for Black lives, and when we think about police accountability, and when we think about the criminal legal system change, I think people start to actually see the interconnectedness between policing and the policing of Black and Latinx communities, and how, you know, what we see on social media is that these things can end in violence and extreme and painful violence. And there's also this other side of policing about where maybe a person isn't dying at the hands of police, but they end up being incarcerated. And so here in Connecticut, our prisons and jails are made up of 70% of Black and Latinx people, even though Connecticut is 80% white. And so I think when we start to have these conversations about the interconnectedness between the movement for Black lives, we start to recognize all the ways that police accountability and the lack of police accountability impacts our communities.
I'd like to talk a bit more about the prison system in Connecticut, but before we do that, Governor Lamont did sign a police accountability bill. Do the provisions in that bill, from your perspective, address the concerns that activists have been fighting for?
I think it's a start. I think that was actually a beautiful moment in history where the outcries of activists and organizers, legislators, Senator Gary Winfield, Representative Robin Porter, and, you know, members of the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus and the Progressive Caucus, they responded to what organizers were calling for and initially drafted a bill that met some of the demands that activists were asking for. And it's a step in the right direction. And the most important thing that I continue to remind folks as we do this work is that it's a positive step and that there's still more work to do.
It's a difficult step for some people, though, people who see this as perhaps an attack on police, police who are not involved in some of these kinds of situations. What do you say to them when talking about an accountability bill like this?
I would repeat what a lot of the legislators that were in favor of the bill are saying, is that as long as you are doing your service to the public in a way that doesn't continue to harm the public, then you shouldn't have anything to worry about regarding accountability. This bill really addresses, you know, what some folks like to call the bad apples in the bunch, or you know, the folks that are the outliers of policing as a whole. This bill really aims to kind of curb those folks. And again, it is a step in the right direction. And so as long as you're doing your job right and serving the community in a way that makes the community feel seen and respected and heard, there shouldn't be any problem.
The prison population in Connecticut, you mentioned that before. Last month, looking at it from a purely numbers perspective for a moment, last month the number of incarcerated people in Connecticut fell by 50%. That's compared to the state's all-time high number, which was, I believe, nearly 20,000 back in 2008. Does that change indicate an improvement of some sorts, and are the policies then working for the people who end up in the system?
I'll do my best to answer this question because, you know, I'm not the numbers person on the team. Mm-hmm. What I will say is that while we continue to see a fall in our overall prison population, what we forget to look at is that people are still being incarcerated at high rates for quote unquote low level crimes. Black and brown communities are still being over policed and incarcerated at higher rates than other members of the Connecticut community. And so again, yes, there are a lot of folks in the last decade or so in Connecticut have worked really hard at reforming our prison system, and there's still just a lot of work to do.
What do you think is the next step that needs to be taken? You mentioned the police accountability bill, for instance, being a good start, the reduction in at least the numbers of people in prison in Connecticut being a good start. What's the next step to continue on a road to improvement of the criminal justice system?
So many things. One of the campaigns that I work on is a smart justice campaign that is made up of all people who are living with a criminal record. And who better knows the ins and outs of the criminal legal system than folks that have been through it? And so there are a lot of various points that in the process of becoming incarcerated and then also being released from the system that the members of Smart Justice talk about. So on the front end, it's what happens when you are released from prison? What are the barriers that come up when you are trying to reintegrate into your community, when you're just interested in supporting your family, going back into work, maybe going back to school? Criminal records really prevent a lot of those steps from happening. And there's still this expectation that after people have served their time and paid their debts to society, that they're expected to just, you know, do the thing and be great and go back to work and not cause any more problems, when there are literally over 500 barriers that stop people living with a criminal record from being able to do that. So that's kind of like the front end. And on the back end of the system, it's examining prosecutorial accountability and what role do prosecutors hold in playing in the incarceration system, and thinking about police, again, the idea of policing, in that we focus a lot on the actual deaths that happen and how communities deserve redress and deserve an opportunity to hold officers accountable for the harms that they cause as a public service position, but also what happens to the people that don't die at the hands of police but end up incarcerated at disproportionate rates. There are people that are held in prisons that can't make bail. There are people that there's a large pretrial population of folks that end up in prison and just end up sitting there for a long time. So there's still a lot of work to be done. And that doesn't go without saying that there are so many people that have dedicated their lives to reforming and changing and transforming the system.
Ms. Fox, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Claudine Fox is a campaign manager with the ACLU of Connecticut. As I mentioned in my conversation with Claudine Fox of the ACLU, Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont last week signed a sweeping police accountability bill. It came in response to the outrage sparked by the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. We're going to take a look at what's in this new law that could change certain aspects of criminal justice in Connecticut. And joining us today are two state legislators who supported that bill, Democratic Senator Douglas McCrory of Hartford and State Senate President Pro Tem Martin Looney, also a Democrat. And we begin with Senator McCrory. Senator, hello, and thanks for taking time today.
Thank you, and thank you for having me and to talk about the bill that we just passed.
Let's take a look at a couple of provisions in this new law, if we could. One involves more training for officers. How will that improve the current system of training?
Well, one of the aspects that we hear about from the public and even from the police department is that they often not, our police officers are not provided the right amount or the quality of training that is needed to patrol in communities across the state of Connecticut. And putting this provision in this bill, I will hope will allow that potential police officers who are going to go out on the streets to do this work, have the ability to be able to work with the communities that they may not be familiar with. So training is very important. But I also will say this, and I've said this many a time, is I do believe training is very important. I want our officers to be trained. I agree. I think training is important. The right kind of training is important. The amount of training is important. But if an individual has in their place that they want to do harm to individuals, then there's no amount of training that can solve that problem. That's a personal issue. And when you have officers who do things that are malicious and that violates people's civil rights, then they need to be held accountable. And I think that's what this bill does.
Well, as you mentioned, this new law mandates some new systems of oversight as well. Can you talk about how that will work?
Well, again, so there's a provision in the bill to have an independent body review cases where there may be a violation of human rights or civil rights. So that individual has the ability to review the cases and make a decision upon themselves, which is totally different from the system, the way the system works now, where you have a chief state's attorney has that provision to review files. And you know as well as I know that the relationships between the state's attorney's office and the police, they commingle so often that sometimes you may or may not get the best objective view. So taking out the hands of the prosecuting, the traditional prosecuting authority, and putting in the hands of an independent individual, I think will be good for the community, and more, and the ideas and concepts will be more subjective than the traditional way we do things.
This was a contentious bill, as you know, and there were demonstrations for and against it. No Republicans voted for it. Some lawmakers said that the bill was anti-police. Others say the bill was well-intentioned but misguided. The police union lobbied against the bill vigorously. How do you respond to those who say that this law will compromise public safety rather than improve it?
I absolutely disagree that will compromise public safety. And yes, and unfortunately, people who are spewing out that this is anti-police, they're wrong. And I will argue that they probably did not even read the entire bill. There's nothing anti-police as the bill is about. This bill is anti-bad police. So if you're a police officer and you're doing your job, doing a job that you were trained to, doing a job that you love, then you have no problems whatsoever. This bill actually holds those bad apples, that bad apple that like the term I use, will be held accountable. Unfortunately, bad apples are not held accountable. And what bad apples do, they start to destroy their barrel, all the apples, and they get painted with a certain brush. And what you're seeing in communities in Connecticut and throughout this country is, in many cases, unfortunately, because a lot of our police officers did not have the ability or didn't have the political will to question or challenge others in their, on their forces, things like this, bad things happen. We have a provision in this bill that will provide opportunities to see, if they see something wrong, they have the ability and have the responsibility to speak up and say something. That wasn't the case before. So I don't think this is a bad police accountability. It's not anti-police. It's pro-police. It's pro-good police. But it will hold bad police accountable.
Did you hear from your constituents as this bill was being debated? What did they have to say?
The vast majority of constituents that I heard from, and I represent North Hartford, Bloomfield, and Windsor, was 90% supportive of the bill. I did get letters from people outside of the community that I represent, and not most of them, but some of them were against it. So in my estimation, the majority of people who understand this, who are looking for change in our societies, looking for different ways of doing things, looking for new ways of policing, supports the bill. And I know it was contentious. I know it was a tough bill for people to take a vote on, but I feel as though it was the right thing to do. People do not like change in society because society traditionally works for the majority of populations. But I'll tell you that this piece of legislation was historic and was needed. And it was needed at this time because of we had these two pandemics that came along. And the fact that we saw people out on the streets marching, asking us to do something different, we had the political will to get it done. And I'm proud of the fact.
In terms of the long view, how do you view this bill? Is this this new law? Is this a first step towards more police accountability, or is it an end in and of itself?
No, I think as things go on, it's a great first step. And again, it's not perfect. There's some things we might have to clean up in the bill, absolutely. But there's no bill that's perfect, so we can come back and revisit this. But I think it's a good foundation. It's a great foundational start to change the way we do business. If you talk to police chiefs, they will tell you it's very difficult to get rid of a bad apple in their departments. This bill gives opportunities for police chiefs to find the easier way to get rid of those individuals that bring shame to the industry of policing. And I think the majority of police chiefs are happy with it. And I think that the public will be happy with it also.
Senator McCrory, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
I appreciate you, and thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Connecticut Democratic Senator Douglas McCrory of Hartford. And now joining us is Connecticut State Senate President Pro Tem Martin Looney. Senator, thanks for your time today.
Hello, Tom. Good to be with you this afternoon.
Could you tell me what in this new police accountability law will help improve how police interact with communities, especially those that have traditionally experienced some disrespect or even violence at the hands of police?
Well, I think this bill is a very far-reaching one to deal with the issue of police transparency, accountability, and professionalism. First of all, it will require that post the training entity for police officer standard training, will have to adopt standardized measures for crowd control. That's one of the problems that we've seen recently in the demonstrations that have occurred since the death of Mr. Floyd, that some towns are better prepared, better able to handle demonstrations, whether it be on the town green or at City Hall or at a police station. Some towns seem not to be well prepared for that and may overreact and are not as skilled as others in peacefully interacting with demonstrators. So this will mandate that there be uniform standards created. That's one of the key elements. Another is that there will be a mandate for enhanced attention to minority recruitment in police departments. There will also be a provision to modify our standards under which deadly force can legitimately be used by police to take into account opportunities for de-escalation of incidents before they rise to the level where the police may use deadly force. Those are all key components of the bill. In addition, there will be a mandate that all police departments have both body cameras and also dashboard cameras, and there are state funds in the bill, state bonding funds, to be used for that purpose also to pay for those costs for the municipalities who adopt that, because currently only some municipalities in the state have adopted body cameras or dash cameras. So that's going to be an important issue of accountability and transparency as well. There are a number of other elements of the bill that we also think will enhance professionalism and accountability. There is a provision regarding police immunity that if officers engage in a violation of civil rights that constitutes a willful and wanton and malicious conduct, in those circumstances, the municipality may be able to attempt to recover from the offending police officer the cost that the municipality incurred in defending that claim. But again, that is only in the circumstance where the officer's conduct has been shown to be extraordinarily egregious.
Police unions spoke out against this bill at times while it was in the General Assembly. I'm wondering, what's the way forward toward cooperation, toward working with the rank and file, with the unions, with the police departments generally, in order to implement these new measures?
Well, I think some of the reaction that we heard from police was reacting to an earlier version of the bill that had been out there in draft form and actually was the one in which an informational hearing or listening session was held. Mm. And there were concerns about that. The police were concerned about that earlier draft and some of the more far-reaching provisions of that, which have been, since were modified and limited in the bill that was actually passed. But there will be dialogue. I know that there are times when alarm is raised. For instance, if you look at this historically, back in 1966, when the U.S. Supreme Court adopted the Miranda versus Arizona decision mandating the rights that would have to be read to suspects at the time they were arrested, there was a huge outcry all over the country from police saying that the days of police being able to successfully interrogate suspects and gain confessions had come to an end, that lawlessness would be rampant all over the country, and there were movements around the country to try to impeach Chief Justice Earl Warren, who was the author of that decision. But in a matter of a few months, it had died down. The police accommodated the warnings into their practice, and business went on as before. So there was a sort of a dire, alarmist hand-wringing that turned out not to be based in fact.
What do you think was the driving force that got this bill passed in the state Senate, especially considering some of the significant opposition and past resistance to these types of accountability rules for police departments?
I think it was the striking example of what happened to Mr. Floyd in Minneapolis, that stark circumstance. In fact, there's a provision in the bill that also requires officers who witness their fellow officers to be engaging in egregious conduct like that, intervene or at the very least report what they have seen so the discipline can occur. And I think the context had changed since what happened on May 25th in Minneapolis. The other element was, I think, the compelling testimony by Senator McCrory and Senator Winfield, Senator Moore, in the chamber about the double standard under which people live, about black parents having to warn their sons when they start to go out in cars as teenagers to be extraordinarily careful in any police encounter. And as Senator McCrory put it, just try to survive the encounter. It's not something that my father had to caution me about when I got to drive, or that my son had to, or that I had to caution my son about, or now that my grandson is just starting to drive, but it's something that black families live with all the time. I think that kind of stark difference in the way police are perceived in the minority communities and the need for greater accountability, control, and careful professionalism is something that I think compelled the final vote in the Senate.
Earlier in the program, we spoke with Claudine Fox, a campaign manager for the Connecticut ACLU, and she called the bill, or the new law, she called it a first step toward this aspect of criminal justice reform. Do you agree? Is this just a first step? More needs to be done?
Well, I think it's a substantial step, and I think that anyone who saw the difficulties and challenges in getting this bill passed would know that it is a major achievement and should not be minimized as a first step. It is a substantial step.
Senator Looney, you shared a personal story during that 10-hour debate about an experience that you had growing up in New Haven. I'm wondering, could you share that with us?
Yes, it happened when I was a teenager, about 17 years old. In New Haven, I was with a friend, and we neither of us had cars, so we walked up several blocks from where we lived to there was a drugstore with a soda fountain. It was kind of a teen hangout, and around the corner from there was an old warehouse or garage that had been converted into a church by an African-American Pentecostal congregation. The neighborhood was overwhelmingly white, but this congregation had rented that church property, and as my friend and I were walking toward home, all of a sudden a black automobile pulled up in front of us, blocked our path, and an elderly minister got out and said that someone had just firebombed and thrown salutes and M-80s and rockets into the vestibule of their church, and that the boys running away were seen by some of his congregants, and they fit our descriptions, and told us that we said, we don't know what you're talking about. We weren't anywhere near. We were on Grand Avenue where the soda shop was, but not on Poplar Street. He said, no, don't deny it. I know you did it. And police have already been called. And at that point, a police car did pull up, and it was a white police sergeant. And the minister began demanding immediately arrest these two boys. And the officer began to question us. He said, where have you been? Took our name and address. And the minister kept saying, arrest these two boys. And the officer turned on him and said, you don't make demands here, I'm in control of the scene, and if you interrupt me one more time, you're the one that's going to be under arrest for breach of peace and interfering with an officer. At that point, it happened at the corner of Exchange Street and Blatchley Avenue, and there was a friend of my parents who lived there, was sitting out on his front porch. He got up and vouched for both of us that we were former altar boys and were volunteers at St. Rose Church, the officer just said to the minister, we're going to investigate this, and just told us to go home and that we'd get a call if needed. And the minister kept protesting, and the officer once again warned him that he was going to take him in handcuffs if he didn't just get in his car and drive away. So we went home, and about an hour later, my friend's father was able to make a contact with the police station, and they told him there that the same two kids who had come back, maybe even while we were in the encounter with the minister, had come back and tried to do it again, and this time had been captured by a couple of the congregants and were being held, and that we had nothing to worry about. But I realized in that encounter that the outcome might have been entirely different. I'm confident it would have been different if the church that had been vandalized and firebombed were one of the Roman Catholic churches in the neighborhood, if the minister had been a white priest from one of those parishes, and if my friend and I had been black. I am sure it would have been a much more dire and difficult evening for us than it turned out to be. So from that point on, I always kept the events of that evening in my mind, and that, in effect, the benefit of being white that I had in that encounter. And I've kept that in mind all the years as a criminal defense attorney when I've represented African-American suspects.
And why did you decide to share that story during the debate over the police accountability bill?
Because I thought it was in some ways a note that supplemented the kind of accounts given by Senator Winfield, Senator McCrory, about the concern and the alienation that that blacks feel in dealing with police in encounters on the street.
Senator Looney, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Absolutely. Happy to speak with you.
Connecticut State Senate President Pro Tem Martin Looney. Civil rights and racial justice movements have challenged Americans to confront how prison can and has been used as a tool of oppression. The fight for the rights for incarcerated people from outside and inside the prison bars has a long history. Professor Robert Chase of Stony Brook University has written a book about it. It's called We Are Not Slaves: State Violence, Coerced Labor, and Prisoners' Rights in Postwar America. I spoke with Professor Chase earlier about his book, which investigates the prison systems of the American South. As part of his research, he gathered the oral histories of prisoners. He says their stories offer a different narrative about the prison system than the ones told by the states that incarcerate them.
Southern prisons made a claim that they were modernized, and what that modernization narrative meant was that northern prisons suffered from cost overruns because of expensive rehabilitative programs. Meanwhile, they looked to New York and the Attica prison riot of 1971, or to California in San Quentin with George Jackson, also in 1971, as moments of prisoner radicalism. And the South claimed, we don't have those things. We're controlled, we're low cost, and we're self-sufficient. Texas prisons cost five times less to hold the same number of prisoners as California and New York. So what prisoners had to do was to create their own modernization narrative. And as a historian of prisoners' rights, we have to look at alternative narratives. And for me, that was oral histories, because after all, the state is the one that documents what is truth and what is not truth. And the state simply claimed that prisoners were lying, that they were convicts, that they were not telling the truth, that there was not a system of prisoners acting as guards, that this was simply untrue. And they claimed this in court, and they claimed this in the media. So to take readers behind prison walls and reveal this violence, my book relied on prisoner testimonies, letters, affidavits, depositions, but also 60 oral histories that I collected with prisoners when the state allowed me to visit the Texas prison system, spend time within its walls, and interview prisoners who created within this prison this social and political upheaval. Now, in the course of doing these interviews, some prisoners had to relate the most intimate and traumatic details of violence, of racial hierarchy, and indeed even the state-orchestrated sexual violence and prison rape at the hands of these trustee prisoner enforcers. And so these were not easy stories for them to recount, but they felt it necessary, I think, to renounce the violence done to them by naming the system that allowed it to happen.
So then, due to the similarity, I guess you would call it, of the oral histories that you collected from the prisoners and the other documentation, that led you to put more of the weight of truth on their side as opposed to the prison system side.
Well, you know, it was just an overwhelming amount of evidence, and it was really almost galling the degree to which the prison claimed that the prisoners were not telling the truth. But here's the point, I think, Tom, and this is what we're experiencing in Black Lives Matter. The documentation of racism, the documentation of racial violence and systematic racism needs to be repeated again and again and again. Why? Because society doesn't want to believe it. They didn't want to believe it in 1978 when it came to Texas prisoners and the prisoners' rights movement nationally. And they don't want to believe it now when it comes to racialized policing. We see it, and we've been seeing it since 2012, beginning with Trayvon Martin, but we've seen it again and again on film, and yet there is still an argument made that it's not systematic racism, but just a few bad apples. And here again in Texas with the prisoner documentation, they understood what Black Lives Matter also understands, is that documentation has to be repeated because they're trying to break that kind of mythology, as Richard Slotkin says, that strikes down the living, that mythology that we're not living in a racist society. And they counter that with their own politics of truth. And these oral histories allowed me to reveal their politics of truth.
You focus on the efforts that prisoners have made to change the system from within. Is it possible to pinpoint when and where this struggle began? Do we have much information about that history?
One thing that historians and now the country as a whole are coming to terms with is the degree to which systems of racial oppression have been embedded in our criminal justice system since its inception. Whether or not that was through the convict lease system that arose in the American South following emancipation, that put many Black people back into bondage, as one scholar called it, slavery by another name, through the criminal justice system, accelerating different kinds of crimes and making things that had once been misdemeanors into felonies, like the very famous pig law that once was a misdemeanor for stealing a small animal in an agricultural society that then was raised to the level of being a felon. And then selling prison labor to private companies that rebuilt the American South, whether or not that was through roads, mining, turpentine, a kind of industrial slavery born out of the convict lease system. And the ironic thing historically is that it's the 13th Amendment that allows this. The 13th Amendment, of course, made it constitutionally illegal for anyone to own a slave, except for those who have been convicted of a crime. Then they could operate as slaves of the state and engage in coerced labor without pay for the state. My book is about a history of resistance emanating out of the American South, out of a labor system that on the one hand worked prisoners in the fields as coerced labor, picking cotton all the way into the 1980s so that they labored as slaves in the daytime. But at night, their bodies were under a system of internal slavery, where they were bought and sold by other prisoners.
Why did you choose this particular southern U.S. prison system as an illustration that connects us with the movements in the 60s, the 70s, and 80s to do away with it, or at least make changes to it?
One of the things that I wanted to think about was how, after an era of civil rights revolution in the 1960s, we still had a society so thoroughly beset by racial discrimination and racial inequality. And although not a lot of historians at the time were talking about it, when I started this project as a graduate student in the early 2000s, we've since come to know that mass incarceration is at the center of so much of the inequality that we see in society today. Because it's not only about 2.2 million people bound up in prisons and jails, but 6.5 million people bound up in the criminal justice apparatus. And this not only is about creating a kind of labor. The prison labor is worth nationally about $2 billion, but it also takes those people out of urban centers, out of families, out of homes, putting them in this system of mass incarceration, which we know statistically is deeply racially disparate, putting far more people of color in prison than those who are white. And on the eve of Brown versus Board of Education, African Americans went to prison at four times the rate of whites. But today, that number is far closer to seven, almost twice the number that it had been in 1954, which is to say that mass incarceration has gotten much worse since the civil rights era, not better, as we might expect.
I'm talking with Professor Robert Chase, Associate Professor of History at Stony Brook University, and we're talking about the research, his research that resulted in his book called We Are Not Slaves, State Violence, Coerced Labor, and Prisoners' Rights in Postwar America. Professor Chase, you pointed out that into the late 70s and early 80s, there were quite a few lawsuits filed challenging the conditions in prisons, painting them as unconstitutional. And you point out that they began to win some of those lawsuits. Did those victories in court change things for them inside?
They did. But any time you write about struggles within prison for civil rights, particularly in this generation, you're writing underneath the pall and the shadow of mass incarceration. So here's what happened. Cases like Ruiz v. Estelle challenged the system of having prisoners act as guards. This was a massive civil rights trial. It was first filed in 1972. The NAACP LDF took up the case, and then it went to trial in 1978 under the Court of William Wayne Justice. You have to like when your judge is named Judge Justice. This two-year trial was, at the time, the longest-running civil rights trial in U.S. history, with over 100 prisoners providing testimony and documenting the violence. And the court agreed with them and declared the Texas prison system as unconstitutional. Across the American South, 8 of the 11 states in the American South received similar kinds of unconstitutional judgments against either their largest prison or the entire prison system. Only 4 states outside of the South receive a similar sweeping declaration. So it was focused on the South. Why was that? In part because they could make an argument that these systems resembled slavery. In Texas, after all, the prisons were built on the land of former plantations, and they worked those prisoners in fields picking cotton with a guard over them on horseback and with a gun clutched in his hands, and it looked and felt very much like slavery. So they won this case, but then southern states, particularly Texas, engaged in what I call carceral massive resistance. Massive resistance was the effort in the 1950s by the South to resist Brown v. Board of Education. Well, in the same way, the state of Texas tried to resist this Ruiz ruling. And for 6 years, there's a struggle that goes back and forth over this system. And finally, a new governor, the first Republican governor since Reconstruction, William P. Clements, decides that he will acknowledge the court's declaration that they were running an unconstitutional prison system. But rather than follow the judge's ruling that all prisons must remain 95% under capacity to reduce mass incarceration, that's what the court wanted to do, was to reduce it, he decides simply to build more prisons. So he uses it as rationale to go to the state legislature and say, we need more money for more prisons. And they build more prisons than any state in the union during the 1990s. Texas went from a system at the beginning of the Ruiz case of 13 prisons, all built in the former slave corridor, to well over 100 prisons. So while these court cases won apocryphal victories that did, in fact, declare them as unconstitutional. The other side of the coin is they won them right under the shadow of mass incarceration.
How would you assess current efforts to reform the criminal justice system, keeping in mind these earlier struggles? Has it evolved? Is there a distinct difference between what's happening now and then? Or is it really not enough at the moment?
Well, one thing that happened was that a new conservative Congress in 1994, coming in on the heels of the conservative counter-revolution, as it was then called, passed a national law known as the Prison Litigation Reform Act. And what the passage of PLRA does is it limits the ability of prisoners to file claims and also to have their attorneys paid and to pay all the processing fees and every possible impediment that you can imagine. And it's planned as a national law to limit the prisoners' rights movement and these kind of civil rights claims. Nonetheless, prisoners have organized in a different way. In 2016, in September, prisoners across the country organized the first national prisoner work strike. And they did it on September 9th, a precipitous date meant to invoke the memory of Attica. And prisoners all across the country refused to work and made a claim that they were incarcerated for their labor and that the prison system required their labor in order to remain profitable and functioning while engaging in a system of dehumanization. And then again, in 2018, there was another national work strike by the Jailhouse Lawyers Speak group after seven prisoners were killed in North Carolina when they were put in with prison gang members and were left there without any assistance as the violence ensued and the bloodletting ended in seven lives. But they made the claim that prisons today are quote-unquote war zones, that prisoners understand that they are being treated as animals. And in addition to asking for a minimum wage, they also ask for the end of the Prison Litigation Reform Act and a system that will understand that even people convicted of a crime are deserving of civil rights and humane treatment.
Professor Chase, thanks so much for sharing your research and your insights with us today.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. It's been a real pleasure.
That was Professor Robert Chase of Stony Brook University speaking about his research that led to his book, We Are Not Slaves, State Violence, Coerced Labor, and Prisoners' Rights in Postwar America. What do you think about Professor Chase's findings? Let us know. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org, and we're on Twitter at @FullStoryWSHU. And that's our program for today, produced by Fatou Sangari and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.